Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Erica Wyatt, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to the catch-up edition of Cooking Issues, coming to you pre-taped. Actually, we're live right now, but we're not streaming live right now, Jack?
I mean, yeah, like technically we're always live.
I mean, we're not dead.
Like we're here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, but the thing is, like, that never, I mean, what does that even mean then? What does live mean? Like, if we're not streaming live, right?
Right.
You can't really say it's live because live implies that, you know, no opportunity for, I guess live implies no opportunity for editing.
Right.
Right.
Although there's always an opportunity.
Yeah, but yeah, there is always an opportunity for editing. Most importantly, self-editing. I guess it's not like we have time to edit these things anyway, right, Jack?
No, so, not really.
So as good as live, because we're not going to edit it. Anything we say is just going to show up on
That's
the thing.
Right.
But don't bother picking up your telephones and calling because we're not at the studio right now. If you're listening to this, we're not here. Right?
I mean,
maybe we are if you listen to this next Tuesday
if you really want to get into it, I'm sure that most of the time when people listen to Cooking Issues, we're not here either when they're podcasting us, you know?
Right. Yeah, but hey, you know, but people do call in. It's like, you know, live-ish.
Yeah.
You know?
Heritage Radio Network, live-ish.
Yeah. Well, and like radio quotes.
Right.
Right? I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. What do you think about this, Stas?
I don't know.
I don't want to get into it. All right, so listen. We are, though, as usual, joined with Nastasha, the Hammer Lopez, and Jack back from where were you, Jack?
I was in Louisville, Kentucky.
And how was that?
It was awesome.
Yeah, what were you
cool
doing?
Cool town. I spoke on a panel called Mastering the Media.
And did you, in fact, master the media?
I was supposed to help others master the media. I told them that podcasts are the Wild West, and they seem to like that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. And so, wow, so like actual radio is like Eastern capitalist bankers, and this is like
right
18. We're all in an episode of Hell on Wheels right now.
Yep.
My God, I definitely don't get to be Cullen Bohannon. Somebody else gets to be Cullen Bohannon, not me. You watch that show, Stas?
No.
Oh, I like that show.
You ever been to Louisville? That was a cool town.
It's a good town.
Yeah, it really is.
It's, they got things that I like a lot. They got your whiskey. Whiskey's delicious.
They have a lot of it. Oh, you know what else they have? You'll appreciate this. I went and visited the Flavor Man. They develop all the soda flavors. It's like a lab, a flavor science lab.
And is it actually one man?
Well, the Flavor Man is one man. His name is Dave, but he's got a pretty big team working for him.
It's kind of a good title. Hi, I'm Dave, the Flavor Man.
Yeah.
Right?
It is a really cool place. I'll show you photos after the show, though.
Were you allowed to take photos?
Yeah. Yeah, they've developed, I mean, they can, like, some they can disclose and some they can't.
They didn't grind up your camera? Did they tell you who the clients are?
They can't tell me all the clients.
He's like, listen, I do all of the Pola brands of soda.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what really ticks me off, Jack, about sodas? And Stas will back me up on this. Everyone drinks these, not everyone. A lot of people drink these like flavored seltzer waters. You know what I'm talking about, Jack?
Mm-hmm.
It started with that, you know, rancid lemon, fake lemon lime flavor that tastes like you dripped Pledge into your water by accident. And then it was like raspberry and black cherry.
Yeah.
Yeah, black cherry. Yeah, yeah. So here's the thing, right? I'm all for people drinking things that they like to drink. But the smaller bottlers, and now here's what really ticks, I think, Stas off, right?
Yeah.
You hate this.
Yeah.
Some of the like larger brand names like Canada Dry hire independent bottlers, right, to do their bottling. And these people run seltzer, God's seltzer, unflavored seltzer water, right, soda water or, you know, sparkling water for those of you that have never been, you know, near New York or whatever. Because some people don't know what seltzer is. Did you know that?
Weird.
They run it through the machines that have had these rancid flavors in them, and they poison. So, like, it's always raspberry with us, right? You crack it open, and you get these, like, raspberry note off your seltzer, and it ruins it. It makes it taste like – it's like, first of all, it makes you think, oh, they're not clean. They're unclean people. And then it also – it's just no good, right? Stas, what are your thoughts on this?
Terrible.
Have you noticed this, Jack?
Yeah.
What the heck is wrong with people? You know what? I've never had – well, look, I don't buy seltzer outside anymore unless I have to because, I make – my own, But have you ever had that problem with vintage?
No, actually, I haven't.
No, God bless a vintage seltzer corporation.
Yeah, what's your seltzer of choice if you have to buy it?
Oh, I mean, I'm a New Yorker, so vintage.
Okay.
Because vintage was always two bottles for a dollar, right? And any real seltzer drinker only buys 1 liter bottles because anything less is a waste because you're going to drink a full liter of it. And anything more is going to go flat. And if your friend comes over to try and drink some and they drink out of the bottle, then you have to throw away 2 liters because I don't want
the bottle. Which friend drinks out of the bottle?
Oh, my God. You know how it is. Or at a party, or they'll crack open a 2 liter at the end of the night.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll pour
one small glass.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then the whole thing sucks.
Yes.
It's like, look, any real seltzer drinker will tell you, right, that first of all, you have to drink everything you buy within about a week because, you know, you want to buy it at a place that has high turnover. So the place where there's dust on top of the bottles of vintage, just ignore, because plastic bottles don't hold CO2 that well and they don't last that long, right? So go to a place that gets a good turnover of vintage, buy a case of 1 liters. Like, that's the way to do it. Right, Stas?
Yep.
I like how we're never going to catch up because we're not going to answer any questions. Well, one more thing. By the way, Searsols are shipping now. We got the notice. Actually, two of them shipped on Tuesday when we did our non-catch-up show.
Are we doing a show on Tuesday? We can talk about that then, right?
What?
Well, Peter and Emma are going to...
Yeah, they're going to come. But anyway, they're shipping. Cool. We've gotten a lot of flack on the Kickstarter over the how long it's taken us to get the product out. We're three months late, which in the Kickstarter terms is like not that big of a deal. And I guess people think because there's not a lot of moving parts that there's not a lot that can go wrong when you're trying to make something like the Searsol. But you're incorrect. You know what happened today, Jack? Somebody said on the Kickstarter, they said what did they say, Stas?
What's going to happen next? The tape on the Amazon boxes won't hold?
Oh.
That's just lame trolling. Oh. Like, you know what? Put your pants on. Get out of your underwear.
Get out of your parents' basement.
Get out of your parents' basement. Go to, just go outside. You know, like, if you're like me and you burn, wear a hat. But get outside. Walk around. You clearly have too much time to troll me. And, I wish everyone happy searing who ordered a Searsol.
Yeah.
And I hope – really, all we really want is for people to enjoy the product.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's all we really
mm-hmm.
want is that for people to have a good product that they can enjoy. We don't want it to get ruined, right, which was, we just want people to, we want it to be good for
mm-hmm.
people. Except that guy.
No, and I have another one.
I hope that – the tape does fall off. His Amazon tape.
That's
does
right.
Fall
I
off
hope that
his.
Box
that's kind of
is
our
not
problem,
stupid.
Though. Then after that,
no. And once Amazon, I guess. Well, it's still until it's in their hands. Hopefully, hopefully a tapeless box arrives, mangled, but still with a pristine Searsol inside to this person's house. And you know what? I still hope they enjoy the Searsol.
Of course.
I hope they enjoy it. Sear in good health and with good. Oh no! And then he or she, I don't really know, appended. Worst Kickstarter ever, which makes us worse than the people.
He's comic book guy then.
Yeah, makes us worse than people who actually never delivered a product. I was compared on Twitter. This is by someone who actually just wants a Searsol, so it's not bad. They were just getting the Samajita.
Oh, okay.
They were getting Samajita.
Okay.
Ajita, mm-hmm. right? Bernie Madoff of cooking equipment. Bernie Madoff. I mean, correct me. But more of a Ponzi scheme, right? So if it was a Bernie Madoff kind of a situation, first of all, right? I mean, like, we would have scammed first, like, something a lot bigger than,
yeah.
like, a $65.
I would hope so, yeah.
$65,
yeah.
Searsol. But it would work more like this. Listen. You send me one screen, and then I'm going to get two people to send you screens, and we're just going to keep doing this forever. Right? Two Searsol screens. That's how it would have worked. That's if I was the Bernie Madoff of Searsol.
It's a pyramid.
It's a pyramid. Sweet pyramid scheme. Pyramid schemes, it never ceases to amaze me how much people continue to love a pyramid scheme. There's a show. I don't know what network it's on. It's called American Greed. You heard about this? I think Stacey Keach is the what's it called? The narrator for it. Remember Stacey Keach? The actor?
I don't.
I think it's him. He used to play detective. He played like Mike Hammer. Yeah, your namesake. And so he narrates this thing on American Greed, and it's all about swindlers who have ripped people off with things that are too good to be true, and it turns out they are too good to be true, and it's always someone in Hoboken or Spokane that's lost their life savings and now they have to work at a gas station even though they're 85 and you know, incapacitated. You know, it's horrible stuff. But then the commercials in it are literally like the commercials that I saw were to invest in what are clearly schemes, like pyramid schemes. Like this one lady comes on, she's like, hey, and like I swear to God, that what they were talking about on the show was this guy who said, listen, I'm going to guarantee you, 12% a year off my real estate investments, and was buying just bunk like real estate that was worthless, and then taking all the new subscriptions and just spending it and paying the dividends out to people. Classic Madoff style stuff, right? Needed to keep getting new people in because he wasn't making any money because he wasn't actually investing in anything worthwhile, right? Literally during that segment, there was a lady in a commercial who was like, guaranteed returns on real estate investments. Oh, can't lose, you know, just blah, blah, blah. I was like, holy crap. I mean, like, the world is a weird place.
Shame on you, CNBC.
Oh, it is CNBC?
It's CNBC.
Shame on you. Shame on you, CNBC, with your money reporting. Okay, some questions. Finally, people's questions. Oh, my goodness. I just punched up the wrong thing. I punched up... stop playing Stereolab. Hold a sec. My iPhone... We're going to get sued because we're not paying our BMI ASCAP stuff.
I think it's
stuff.
Okay if it's through an iPhone speaker through a microphone. Yeah. I think then all bets are off.
Well, somehow I looked up Dropbox to get the cooking issues up, but instead it picked up Stereolab Blips Drips. So let me get the actual questions up here. Oh, maybe I should switch back to the iPad. I'm having some severe bad luck when I try to iPhone this thing, even with my new phablet. Fablet.
Oh, you're using that word.
I know, it's a terrible word.
Why is it fab?
Phone, yeah. Tablet. Fablet. But it sounds gross. It's just gross.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I only use it to be kind of like a jerk because it's a terrible word. Okay, Brandon Bird writes in. It's not Brendan Byrne Arena. It's Brandon Bird. Very close. I would love for him to go to a concert at... Do they still call it the Brendan Byrne Arena?
I don't know.
Where did you see Fleetwood Mac? Stas, you saw Fleetwood
MSG.
Mac.
You saw Fleetwood Mac? That's awesome.
She said they played for 4 freaking hours.
Three.
Yes. They played for 12 hours. they were their own opening band.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And by the way, Stas, well-known disliker of Stevie Nicks before, but now...
Not dislike, just did not like her...
Compared
to Christine McVie.
Right, but now... You more
no,
respect.
I have a lot of respect for her. Yeah, that voice.
She's
is
the
good.
Best.
Yeah, that voice is really. Good.
Oh, don't go that far. Still a Christine McVie fan over here.
Yeah, still like Christine.
But you know, just now she
but
has
her
equal
presence on stage. Wow.
Who, Stevie Nicks?
Yeah.
You know who I saw? Like, actually, I guess a little bit later era in was Ann Wilson from Heart.
Mm.
Right, Ann Wilson. Mm-hmm. Right, she kicked some serious behind.
It's awesome.
She just tore up the stage when I was at Tales of the Cocktail.
Oh.
Yeah, just tore it up. Love to see that. Okay. Brandon Bird from Chicago writes in, hello, Hammer Dave and Jack, or whoever's working the booth this time. By the way, I fired up a Searsall last week, and what was her name, Elizabeth?
Yeah.
She was like, oh, my God, the boards are breaking, and she just cut all the mics out.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because she heard anyway. Don't worry, we got Jack
nice
back.
First day on cooking issues for poor Liz.
Yeah,
and with lots of shark meat.
Oh, all this like fermented shark meat.
Great.
Yeah. A few questions for you. I recently used my pressure cooker to render some ground beef fat inside mason jars, and I noticed a curious phenomenon. After cooking for 2 hours and cooling the jars down to room temperature, they still bubbled and boiled. Bubbled and boiled. Do you like the word boiled? Or does it sound too much like spore moiled?
No. Boiled is fine.
Boiled? Mm-hmm. Boiled. Somewhat vigorously, even after the jars were cool to the touch. What is up with that? Okay, so I'll answer that first. So assuming you're doing the pressure cooking in the jars, a la modernist cuisine has a section on rendering out lard in the pressure cooker, because the good news about rendering lard in the pressure cooker is that let's go through it. When you're rendering – not lard in this case, fat. When you're rendering fat, you need to get the temperature above – you want to get the temperature above boiling, because not all the fat's going to render out at 100 anyway. So you need to heat the fat up not just enough to melt the fat, but to break it loose from its the connective tissue where it is and render it out, and you get the cracklings and you get the – well, it depends. With pork, you get the cracklings and you get the whatever else. Right? You with me, Stas? Kind of. the good news about a pressure cooker is that you can't you're not going to boil off all of the water that's in it, so you're going to get basically a constant 200 and in Fahrenheit, constant like 250 something degrees Fahrenheit until you've actually steamed all of the water out. So it's a good way to regulate the temperature of the stuff that you're rendering so that it's not going to get any burns in it, it's not going to brown out, it's clear and beautiful and stuff like this, right? Still has a lot of the water in it, though, so you have to then separate the water out or, like, solidify it. So this is, like, the premise. Now, another thing that people do is they add baking soda to the fat when it's rendering. Supposedly makes it whiter in color. Baking soda is alkaline, so it's probably shifting, making sure that it's not too acidic. It's probably also reducing the you know, the amount of free fatty acids. I don't really know, but it's like a known thing to add some baking soda to it. And the Modernist Cuisine guys do exactly that. So here is what I think is happening. Baking soda starts to degrade at temperatures even without – so typically when you're using baking soda, right, you take baking soda and you add an acid to it and then you get a reaction where you're you are forming carbon dioxide, right? And that's how the leavening works. However, baking soda, even not in the presence of an acid, will start to decompose and form carbon dioxide, and it'll do that at temperatures inside of a pressure cooker. So my guess about what's happening – and I asked Chris Young about it too. I asked him about it. My guess is that when you're heating up the stuff in the jar, right, you're decomposing some of the you're decomposing some of the baking soda. That's forming carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide is then going into solution in the water. It might also be in oil. I don't know about the solubility of CO2 into oil. I mean, I know N2O is very soluble in oil. That's why we use it in whipped cream. I presume CO2 is somewhat soluble in oil, but I really don't know. But there's also still water phase in there, remember. So what you're doing is you're putting a large amount of CO2 – or not a large amount, but an amount of CO2 into the liquid at a relatively high pressure. And I'm presuming that when it cools off, as the pressure decreases, the CO2 is bubbling out. Or maybe it's still producing CO2. I don't know. To me, it's got to be a CO2 effect. I can't think of anything else, reason why, after it's cooled to the touch, it would continue to bubble unless it's continued production of CO2. I mean, that's all I can think about. And then as the pressure reduces, more stuff will bubble out. But on the other hand, as it cools, it becomes more soluble. So who knows? It's a crapshoot. But this is the only thing I can think of, and Chris seemed like it seemed reasonable. But I don't know. It's an interesting phenomenon. Anyone else who knows, please write in and tell us. Oh, and here's some stuff. This also, by the way, he is a fan of these flavors.
Really?
Of these seltzer flavors. Like you, I'm a big fan of bubbles. Hello, seltzer. And quite enjoy mixing carbonated water from my soda stream with fresh citrus juice. Do you like that word?
Yes.
Yeah. I also quite enjoy citrus-flavored carbonated beverages from brands like... Strong.
That sound, man.
Yeah, like can we just have that as like our like
Yeah, I gotta get that on the sound effects board.
Yeah. Her flavored seltzer noise. Like La Croix. La Croix. How do you think that like Americans pronounce this thing? La Croix.
I guess.
The Crocs. LaCroix. LaCroix, I guess, Americans? LaCroix. Yeah, LaCroix. Do you have any insight as to how beverages like that are produced? Is it simply a matter of dosing carbonated water with essential oils, or is there something else involved? Okay. First of all, no, not essential oils. Essential – when you're using oils, oils have to be suspended in an emulsion. They're typically not clear. When you add them to the classic one of this is citrus beverages like Sunkist, which aren't clear. They're a little bit cloudy, and it's because they have emulsified oils in them. Those emulsified oils need to be stabilized. And so for short stabilization periods, you can act, if you want to do this, you can do this. You can get essential oils, and you can emulsify them with gum arabic and very strong into kind of a water slash or alcohol slash oil emulsion with gum arabic water. I would do water and then add stabilize with alcohol if you need to. But anyway, boom. So you have this like essential oil that's emulsified. It's going to be cloudy looking, like white cloudy, like chalky water. That you can then add to soda and you can drink it like that. It's fine. And because the emulsion size is very, very small, so you're not going to get a lot of excess bubbling. It's not like adding like lemon juice to it or something like this. You're not going to get a huge amount of bubbling out. You're going to be okay because the particles are too really small to cause a lot of nucleation, presuming you do it right. Right? So you should be okay there. In the business, though, the gum arabic isn't stable enough to have it suspend for a long, long time. So what they do, what they used to do, is they would use brominated vegetable oil. And the bromine makes the oil – remember, oil is lighter than water. So the bromine that they add to the essential oil makes the basic oil droplet heavier, because part of it is the essential oil and part of it is brominated vegetable oil. And that has a weight that's heavier than water. So when you add the oils together into the droplets, they get a relatively neutral buoyancy and they don't want to float out. And by adding brominated vegetable oils, you can get a citrus beverage that's going to be stable through the next ice age, roughly. But, you know, that order of magnitude. Or, you know, till we have a nuclear war. Whatever. Whatever it is. Nuclear war, ice age, whichever comes first. Whatever. However, people don't like brominated vegetable oil anymore because there might be some health risks, et cetera, and so people have moved away from it. And now, like one of the replacements that they're using is something called sucrose acetoisobutyrate, or SAIB for not as crazy, which apparently is non-toxic, but I really know relatively little about it because I don't do that. I don't really do that kind of stuff for a living, right, Stas? Mm-hmm. We don't do that. But the way they make the clear beverages is they use extracts, right? So the extracts are only stuff that are soluble in water and alcohol usually. Some of them will cloud when they're dissolved, depending on how they do it, but usually they'll compound those flavors such that they don't cloud up when they're diluted and they work. So the flavors aren't going to be the same. That's why these things don't really taste like real – I mean, they're not really – like you're losing whole parts of the citrus when they're doing that, because they're adding only compounds that are that, you know, are going to be soluble in water and stay clear. And there's specific people that make that. So you're going to buy – you're going to buy the extract that's right for that. And by the way, just because the flavor is natural – do people know this in general? Just because the flavor is natural, Flavor Man, doesn't mean that it's the flavor that you are buying.
Yeah, we talked about this.
Yeah. So usually if you say something has natural lemon flavor, right, and you don't want to say on it – although lemon's – whatever. But you don't want to say on it natural lemon flavor with other added weirdness, right? What you do is you say the lemon flavor, it has to have some component from a lemon in it, right? And then womph. Womph. Which, W-O-N-F, with other natural flavors. And all it means is they make purified chemical flavors from natural sources and then dope it back in. So there's really no... I mean, in my estimation, no advantage really. That's why, like, natural flavor versus artificial flavor, like, unless someone literally is doping something with a poisonous flavor, really means nothing to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, I don't really care. Like, I care, does it taste the way I want it to taste? You know what I mean? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, he was saying nothing that's labeled cherry would ever have cherry in it. It's all benzaldehyde.
Yeah, it just depends on where they get it. If they get it from a natural source, then it's a natural flavor. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then if there's like one molecule from a cherry somewhere in there, then you're good. You know, it's like it's an absurd thing. It's an absurdity that, like, you know, we focus on – it's because as soon as you have something with a label and then there's a rule for that label, then companies will figure out how to work around that label to make the product in a way that's good for the company to make that product that fits the letter of the law for the label. That's it. You know? Nah, whatever. But anyway, I have no problem with flavors as long as they taste good. Do you like Applejack, Stas?
The
cereal?
Yeah, I love that.
Right? Mm-hmm. But but what do they not taste like?
Apples.
Yeah.
That's why I like it, though.
Yeah, well, we've talked about this on the air before, I think, but there was a commercial a number of years ago where these the kids were like, these don't taste like apples. And then Stas was on saying, but I still love them, right? Because
yeah, that was in, what, 87?
Something like that. I don't know. It's like, but it's, like, the thing is,
wait,
like,
you were on the commercial?
No.
Oh. No. It might as well have been
Stas.
That'd
be awesome.
Might as well have been Stas. But like the thing is, the point is of all this, is that people like Apple Jacks because they taste like Apple Jacks, not because they taste like apples. And like whether the flavor is real or not, or, you know, artificial or natural, you know, is not an, if what you care about is not having stuff that's been dorked and mucked with, then real or natural is not the label you should be looking for, right? Whatever. But Dawes clearly doesn't care about that because she just wants her Apple Jacks to taste like Apple Jacks.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Anyways. Fruity rings. Stas, for a minute, if I can, for a minute. The flavors of gummy bears that you like versus the flavors you don't like are which ones?
I like the white ones.
And that's it?
I can deal with the red and the green, but the rest can go.
Which are the ones you specifically don't like?
Yellow and orange. Well, most people don't like yellow and orange of anything.
Jack, what are your thoughts on this? Is that true? She's a believer that most people are not a fan of the yellow. And that, why? The yellow, you get too much of a Lemon Pledge flavor?
I mean, it depends.
As a kid, when you got a bunch of yellow and oranges of anything, and it was always the majority.
Oh, yeah. I used to buy
the red. Red is what everyone wanted.
Red ones, yeah.
Yeah.
I used to buy the, you know how Tic Tacs used to come in dual flavor packs? Like they would mix? Maybe they still do. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Two colors in one? I used to love the yellow orange pack.
Of course.
Oh, the orange Tic Tacs are good. Yeah. I like those.
Oh, no.
What about the tangerine lifesavers?
No, I don't like orange-flavored candies.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you like orange sherbet or sorbet?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. But I wouldn't.
Do you like creamsicles? Cause,
yeah, creamsicles
good.
Good.
All right, because otherwise we would have had a fist fight right here. I would have lost, but we would have had...
You have the simian crease.
I have the simian crease, but like I don't have like a high enough level of anger right now.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's like, yeah. So I have a simian crease.
Tell them what it means.
What it means is that, you know how, what are those two lines? Anyone a palm reader here?
No, well, Jack, you have multiple lines not. In your palm. Everyone has multiple lines in their palm.
Yeah, and you usually have one that's like coming around your thumb and curving down, and then you have one that curves up coming over from your pinky, right?
Yeah.
I don't. I got one line that goes straight across.
And that means?
Oh, it's a simian crease. So either I'm a monkey, hence the simian. Then certain you know, people with genetic dispositions towards mental retardation also have it. But we pop... You know, who I now feel for deeply because he had his Kickstarter delays with Nomiku from Thailand. Came, he's like, oh, in Thailand, that means that you're going to murder someone by accident. I was like, what the hell? Who the hell has, like, this specific palm reading thing based on...
No, I think, like, after autopsy stuff, probably they were like, oh, that man has it and that man has it. And they all murdered somebody.
Case closed.
By accident.
Yeah.
But it was by accident.
By accident.
It was specifically by accident.
That.
It was specifically they did it, but they were doing it by accident. Which seems bizarre.
They had gotten a fist fight.
he didn't say fist fight. You're just adding this now. You're just adding stuff.
No, I'm saying that's probably what happened.
I don't know. All right, last question from Brandon Bird. Also, a couple weeks back, you answered a question about storing flowers and other powdered starch products in a freezer from someone who had an allergen concern. We have another question. That was – who had the allergen? Because it was a Sam? Anyway, I'll look it up. You mentioned you regularly store high-end flowers in the freezer that you haven't noticed any appreciable decline in quality. I'm wondering why that's so, considering that you advise against storing baked starch products like bread in the freezer because of the negative effects caused by starch retrogradation. Best, Brandon Bird. First of all, freezing bread is okay. Freezing it. The problem is refrigeration storages in bread. So, and the general rule of thumb in the literature, the industrial literature, I don't want to say scientific, it's more industrial literature, on bread baking and bread storage is that a single freeze-thaw cycle that you go through, and by the way, you want to freeze it quickly and you want to thaw it quickly, but that single freeze-thaw cycle is worth about a day's worth of storage in terms of staling at room temperature, which is why if you're going to – but once it's frozen, you don't lose anything. So if you're going to freeze bread, right, and you're freezing it today – right, then it's like when you thaw it to eat it right away, it's like you're eating it tomorrow night, right? But if you wait till tomorrow night to freeze it, it's like you're losing another day after that. Does that make sense to us?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the if freezing it itself isn't the problem. It's as it goes in and out of freezing. The real problem is refrigeration temperatures. Okay. The other thing is that the flours don't fit those rules at all because starch retrogradation only applies to starches that have been cooked, right, and you know, hydrated with water. And then over time, those the starches recrystallize, right? And so then the water becomes unbound that goes stale. So starch retrogradation is only a problem in starches that have been cooked already and where you don't want to have them recrystallize. Yeah? Make sense? Okay. Oh, and he also adds, P.S. going through your back episodes, I noticed that you solicited names for the product that became the Sears All. Being late to the game, I thought I'd throw my hat into the ring in hopes that you come out with a larger format tabletop broiler in the future. My suggestion, the Hellbender. Hellbenders are monstrous amphibians, the largest salamanders native to North America. They look scary and have a sweet name. I know you like salamander puns. Piper really used to like the salamander puns. And Hellbender sounds much better than Sally Hander, sorry Pipes, or Sally Matic, no offense. He says no offense to Piper. Not me, don't worry. Looking for Piper, whatever, I don't know. If I see him, I'll ask him. Looking forward to getting my all-searing eye sometime soon. Cheers, Brandon Bird. Okay. Michael writes in, hello, Dave, Anastasia, and all Mother Masters of Sound. Ooh, I like how you like that, Jack. Master
nice.
Of Sound.
Mother Master of Sound? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
All other.
And all Masters of Sound.
Yeah. Okay, so all whoever, Masters of Sound.
I like Master of Sound, though. I like Mother Master
Mother
of Sound. That's
of
my
Masters.
Next band, Mother Masters of Sound.
I like that.
Sweet. Someone make that band. Like, just do some garage, what's it called? Garage Band on your new iPhones. And,
oh, wait, do you want to tell them about the new phablet. Indie Jesus here?
No, I don't want to talk about that. We don't have a name for him yet.
Okay.
There. Well, although Daniel Gritzer, who is here on Tuesday, came up with a sweet name. What was it?
Santa's Little Hipster.
Oh, yeah. Santa's Little Hipster.
You know who we're talking about, Jack?
No.
He's new.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. It's the new indie Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah. But he's not Jesus related, but he is Christmas related. He's Santa's Little Hipster. He's awesome. And I don't want anyone. He's not a dwarf. Don't come back and say that we're.
No,
he just looks like an elf, but with like hipster elf.
There's
elf.
A reason for this nickname. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it has nothing to do with his height. So don't write in and say that we're bad people. Okay. How much salt do you add to food when cooking, not brining? Is it possible to calculate? Is it based at all on water content in food? Also, does perception of salt really change when it is added at different stages of cooking? Also, can one calculate how much of a spice or herb to add when cooking? And ratios of one spice to another overall, are there universal constants? No. I don't think so. I mean, I always – there's certain recipes that you know what's going to happen, and so you add definite percentages. So breads. You typically add a percentage, and every baker knows what percentage they are going to add of salt, and you typically then – you're salting on flour basis, not on flour and water basis, because after it's all said and done when you bake, you really care about the quantity of salt in the final product, not in the not in the dough, and usually your hydrations level out when you bake, right? I mean, let's be honest. Unless it's like something really, really dry. And so typically for a given recipe style, like a cookie or a bread, you'll use a particular percentage. And I used to use, you know, McGee told me about this bread writer in San Francisco who's apparently well known, used to work, I think, at Acme. And he, I forget his name. And, you know, he wrote that in the old days we would use like a percent to a percent and a half of salt, which is what I typically would have used in bread back in the day, bread and pizza dough, things like this. He says modern people are pushing up like over 2% on salt, which it seems high, but you know, anyway, but the point is that salt levels, I guess, have been rising up in a lot of these artisan breads over the past couple of decades. But yeah, so that has a definite percentage. And I think you can do the same thing with other things. Made a noise, didn't mean to. With other things that are kind of uniform. So you know when rice comes in, like that doesn't have salt in it. And so you could calculate, I haven't done it, but you could calculate a percentage that you're going to add of salt to rice before you cook it. What I would do, if I did it, I would take the rice that you make, I would take a batch, make a batch, weigh it, and then you know exactly what the weight is of a particular rice after you cook it, and then do a percentage basis on that, like a percent or so, probably a percent. Percent to whatever. But when you're dealing with things, other things, especially things that have some their own inherent salt in them, you never know how much salt you're going to need to add because you don't know what the flavor of the original thing was. And certain things require more salt than others based on the levels of other flavors that are present in them. You know, does that make sense to us?
Mm-hmm.
And as to whether you should add it before or after, I think a lot makes a difference. If you add salt to bread afterwards, then you're a nasty Tuscan person. And we all know Tuscan bread is terrible. It just tastes awful because they don't put salt in it. So you have to clearly, with bread, add it before you make it, when you're making the dough. It can also make a difference, for instance, in bread when you add it, because it also changes how fast the yeast works. When you're soaking beans in salted water, the salt can change the rate of the absorption of the water into the beans. So like in certain cases, it makes a functional difference when you add the salt. But in other cases, I think it almost always makes sense to add salt as you're cooking. Oh, another one, meat. If you add salt to meat before you cook it, if you add it a long time before you cook it, then it can change the texture of the meat, right? So that's why if I'm doing a long cook of something like a steak and I want it to taste like a fresh, like a broiled steak, I won't add the salt if I'm going to cook it for a long time because I don't want the texture of the meat to taste more like a cured texture of meat, which it will if the salt's there for a long time, well, especially when it's cooking for a long time. Okay, so there you have it on that, but it – other than that, or for instance, I'm sorry, if you're going to make a stock, you don't add the salt now because you don't know what form you're going to use the stock and you're going to reduce it and then your salt level's all wrong. However, when you're using ingredients and you know that the ingredients that you're preparing it into its final state, like for instance, I'm making a sauce and this sauce is going to go on something else, right? I want the sauce to taste the right level of salt, so I'll salt the sauce while I make it. I also want the meat that I'm putting the sauce on to have the right level of salt, so I'll have the meat taste good if you were to taste it without the sauce. I think in general, if you follow the rule, have everything taste good on its own in terms of its salt level. When you combine them, they'll still taste good. I'm not such a fan of saying I'm going to make one bland piece of crap and then I'm going to put something really salty on top of it because then the two things are unbalanced on their own. And what if someone takes a bite of one and not the other? Or what if you have a piece of potato that you didn't salt the water because for some reason you don't like to salt water? I don't know what's wrong with you. I don't know why you didn't salt your potato water. But if you did that, right, and some guy got a big chunk of potato with a little bit of salt on the outside, well, that potato is going to be bland because the interior of that potato is not going to have any freaking flavor, right? Whereas a person has a small piece of potato, they're not going to have too much salt because they have relatively more sauce on it. So in that situation, I would say add the salt all at once. You know what I mean? Okay. Would that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Okay. What do you think, Jack? Is that okay?
Yeah, I think you got it.
All right. And same thing with spices. First of all, spices are even worse, like spices and herbs, because the relative pungency or power of a given spice or herb is wildly dependent on how old it is, where it was sourced, the variety it is, et cetera, et cetera. So there's really no rules. That's why when people ask for recipes and you give them a recipe and, like, you know, it's got, like, I don't know, thyme in it. I don't know how much thyme you need to add. Why don't you just chop up the thyme, and then when it tastes right, you're done. You know what I mean? But you're not allowed to write a recipe that says, add the amount that makes it taste good.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? People hate when you write recipes like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm famous for with my interns. I was well known for always just saying, make it taste right, sucker. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways. Okay.
I just fast-blasted you something. We had a question from Andrea in Germany that has gone unanswered for a while.
Just put that one? Because I have that one here, right here. Like, it's the next one on the thing. But we didn't get to that one?
Yeah, right. He's sent me a few emails here this week, so.
Andrea with eggs. Hi there. I have a question for Dave on cooking issues. I'm from Germany and listen to your show regularly. I have a question regarding baking without eggs. I am not a vegan, but don't tolerate eggs. And all my attempts at baking cakes have been awful. Bunt. I like that word, bunt. Bundt and sponge cakes turned out extremely moist and heavy, not light and fluffy at all. This might be okay in a fudgy brownie, in fudgy brownie-like cakes, but I am looking for a sponge chiffon cake. You don't like sponge, right? The word.
No.
Sponge chiffon cake that is usually just made with eggs, flour, sugar, and baking powder. And that can be used for layering cakes with whipped cream as for Swiss rolls, kind of like an angel food cake, but with the yolks also being used. I've tried various egg replacers, but they don't work well either. Do you have any idea and a good recipe for that? Thanks for your help, Andrea. Okay. Well, okay. Eggs are a miracle, right? And so, like, they have various different functions, and in different cakes, they do various things. Obviously, they add structure in the form of protein. Let me see whether I actually anything. They add structure in the form of protein, in angel food cakes, they add in angel food cakes, they add actual foam, right? So you whip them into a foam and you beat it in. So there's usually not a single egg – and also there are emulsifiers, right? Because when you're adding egg yolks or something, you add fat and emulsifiers, which can also improve the texture of cakes. So I don't think you're going to find any one single egg replacer that's going to replace all of the all of the different functions that eggs can perform, even within a cake. That said, there are people working on this problem right now. Notably, Bill Gates is a big investor in a company that's doing – there's two, I think, main fake egg companies in – they're both in California, of course. And one of them – is already come out with a non-egg mayonnaise, right? What's that? Jack, do you know what this is called? Maybe you could do a quick search for me. And there's another company that's working on eggs that can literally be scrambled and eaten as though they were an egg. So they're looking to get the color right, the texture, and I guess also somewhat the flavor.
Wait, so it's a non-egg product that can be scrambled?
That's right.
Okay.
And I've seen it. Hmm. And here's the thing, right? And I talked to Harold McGee about this, and I think Nathan Myhrvold was actually was pimped out for one of the products where, like, they cooked it at his place and served it to someone else, and that someone else, who's by no means an egg expert, was like, "Tastes like an egg to me." Here's the thing, like, when you're like, this is a classic vegetarian argument against meat, is that you can just make a meat replacer and that most people can't tell the difference. Well, most people can't tell the difference between a piece of meat that's been cooked to death and a meat replacer that's been cooked to death, because once it turns into a piece of shoe leather, who the hell cares whether it came from an animal or from a vegetable? You know what I'm saying? There is no one on God's green earth that can take and make something yet that I'm like, that tastes exactly like a medium rare rib steak. You know what I mean? That has the same freaking texture as a medium rare rib steak. You ever had that happen to you, Jack?
No, of course not.
No. They're like...
But like, if you want to, serve like good mushrooms or something, I don't know.
They're delicious. Like, they're delicious. But like the meat replacing people are like, when I make an overly spiced chili that would have had overcooked, particleized, crappy hamburger meat in it, you can barely tell that you don't have the particleized, crappy hamburger meat. Well, that's not really a fair judge of whether or not you're making a good meat replacer.
Brooks's hamburgers are pretty good.
They're not hamburgers. They're good. They're a good patty product. They're a good patty product. I would eat it on a bun. In fact, have many times.
By the way, how's this for a word? It's the veg.
Ooh.
The veg?
The 100% plant-based egg yolk replacement.
Oh, veg with two E's.
Yeah.
Two G's, rather. Yeah. Veg. Yeah, I don't know. I think with, when you got Gates money behind you, you can't do better than veg.
I don't know if that's the one.
Maybe it's veg. Veg.
Veg?
No, but it's like supposed to be like the incredible edible veg. Veg? Anyway. But the point is that I'm sure that you can make something that approximates a really poorly cooked, overcooked scrambled egg, especially if you're going to dump a bunch of Tabasco sauce onto it and eat it with hash browns. Then, yeah, you probably could. But replacing an actual egg, whatever. What am I talking about? We're talking about cakes. So typically when you're doing a cake – it depends on what you want to replace. You need to leaven somewhat, so you're going to need some way to aerate it. You could do that with commercial leaveners, but in order to get that spongy chiffon-like thing, you might want to you're going to need to add some sort of protein to it. Although you could add some protein to it actually as well. That'll mimic some of the stuff. But you're going to want to add something that stabilizes the bubbles in it while it's forming, because you're not going to have the egg structure to hold it together while it's baking. So what you'll do in an egg replacer is you'll add some form of thickener, like some hydrocolloid thickener, and xanthan gum. And xanthan gum will hold the structure while you're baking. But there are some alternatives that that you could try. I'll give you some. So Johnny Azzini and I, years ago, and I think he actually published this recipe, so you can go look for it somewhere. I think he published it. We're working – we wanted to do an angel food cake style thing that didn't have any egg whites in it. And the reason is we didn't want to have that kind of protein feeling from the egg whites that you get from egg whites in an angel food cake. So we used ISI or EC whippers, whipped cream whippers, to produce the foam texture. And we used methylcellulose. So Methylcell, which is a Dow brand of sometimes methylcellulose, sometimes hydroxypropyl methylcellulose, blah, blah, blah. But they have the interesting property that they gel when you heat them, right? So we added, I believe it was methylgel, the SG, I think it was SGA7, 7C. It's been a long time, but I think he published it. I can't remember exactly. It's been a long time. But anyway, so you add this methacel to your batter. You put the batter in an EC whipper. You charge it with a bunch of N2O. You foam it into the pan, and you throw it in the oven. The bubbles are formed already from the foaming in the EC whip. And then as it heats, it sets very quickly into a gel. The gel holds the shape of the angel food cake-like thing while it bakes. And then when it cools off, the starch holds it together, so you don't need the egg anymore. So that was one way to do it. Another way you could probably do it is by making a fluid gel, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later for a different question that comes in. You can make a fluid gel with you wouldn't want to use agar because agar will break in the oven at those temperatures. But you use low acyl gelan, which is a hydrocolloid. You can make a pretty thick fluid gel actually, and use that for the water base of the cake. You could even do it milk based if you wanted. Use that as the water base of the cake, and that will provide some structure such that after it aerates, the bubbles won't pop. But you might need to pre-aerate, or you could probably maybe get away with just the aeration from creaming. I don't know. Depends on what kind of cake you're going to make. If you're going to make one with fat, or if you're going to make one that needs to be aerated by whipped egg whites. If you're going to do something that needs something like whipped egg whites, you could use VersaWhip to whip together a liquid base and then set that with xanthan or some form of fluid gel so that it doesn't break. There's a bunch of different things you could go through, or you could just try a commercial egg replacer. Does this make any sense?
Uh-huh.
Anyway. If you need more information, give me a holler. I don't have any recipes off the top of my head, but again, look, Johnny Azzini might have published that recipe we did. It was years and years ago, like 6 years ago or something like that. Chris Shenton writes in on brine penetration. Howdy, Dave, the hammer. He could Joe in the tools. Well, Joe, you know, Jack. Joe did come back that 1 week, though.
Yeah, Joe's around sometimes.
Yeah.
He's pretty famous.
Yeah, my man Joe. Yeah. We've been brining our chickens, if non-kosher, since the Oldie Cooks Illustrated article popularized it. We also brine fish to prevent protein bleed out. Typically, for chicken or pork, we do a 5% solution for 12 hours or so. Works fine, no problems there, and we like the results. We believe we understand the process, osmotic pressure, higher or lower salt concentrations, etc. But we've seen a number of brines that include non-water-soluble flavorings. Thomas Keller's chicken brine, for example, has honey. Okay, that's water-soluble. But also bay leaves, garlic, peppercorn, rosemary, lemon, onion, thyme, parsley, etc. Since these herbs and spices are not water-soluble, can they actually penetrate the protein and flavor the meat? Even if they can they penetrate more than the surface layer of the flesh? Even if so, which herb spices would imbue more flavor more successfully, and what's the mechanism? Thanks for all the great info on cooking issues. Chris Shelton. Shenton, rather. Okay, here's the thing. A lot of that stuff is water-soluble, but the most larger molecules, salt is a relatively small molecule, and also the interesting thing about salt is that salt, as well as acids, radically affect kind of how proteins in the muscles act. And so they can have a very big effect, and then the question is whether or not like they penetrate the surface or whether they don't. Most spices are really on the surface. Salt, there's some arguments on how much penetration you get on salt, but I'm going to refer all of you, rather than having a discussion of it myself, I'm going to refer to you to what a couple of years ago was not that widely read a blog as far as I can tell, but everyone should go take a look at it. It's genuineideas.com. It's a guy, I think he's some sort of scientist. His last name is Blonder. Genuineideas.com has done the best work on brining ever, because he cooked a bunch of stuff, and here's what's cool. He cooked a bunch of stuff, and then after he cooked it and sliced it, soaked it in salt revealing dyes that could actually show the penetration of salt of an actual cooking, not marking penetration based on dye penetration, but actual on salt penetration on the cut surfaces of meat. So I just, rather than going into it, I recommend you all read that. And then if we want to have some discussion about his section on brining, then we can. But it's excellent. So go take a look at that. Matt Maroon writes in on foam. Hey, guys. I made an awesome hot toddy using mulled apple cider, Angostura bitters, dark rum, fat wash with brown butter and maple syrup. I topped it with Le Bernardin's caramel foam. By the way, when you say Le Bernardin, it means Michael Lascanus is formerly Le Bernardin, great, great, well-known pastry chef. Caramel foam. And then give me a link to the recipe. And the recipe is a quarter cup sugar, tablespoon water, 2 large egg yolks, 3/4 cup heavy cream, 3 tablespoons plus a teaspoon of whole milk, and a half sheet half of a 2 gram sheet of gelatin. So basically, you're making a gelatin stabilized whipped cream in the ISI. It was done in an ISI, foamed out, bop. Okay, okay, that's how Lascanus did it. One person who drank it noted that if you drink too slowly, the foam melts and leaves an unappealing mess floating on the cider. You know what? It's like, you know, your friends can't just accept the freaking drink you gave them. They have to, like, complain about the unappealing mess and the service. It's typical, right?
Yeah, typical.
You know what? It's like I was like, okay, so, like, when the iPhone was coming out, right? Like, they were having problems with the store because I happened to be up. I was working, actually, interestingly, on Sears All stuff. I was working on stuff when they went on sale at 3 a.m. my time, right? So I go on, and the Apple store is not working. I'm like, these guys didn't get their store up on time. I was like, oh, yeah, people make mistakes. You know? Your friends should get – people make mistakes. You know? I'm so much more forgiving now. After I've had to go through it, I'm much more forgiving of when things go wrong, you know? So your friend needs to give you a big bad break on that. But anyway, yes, we're going to solve your problem anyway. The foam melts and leaves an unappealing mess floating on the cider. Is there anything I could do to slow that down, like methylcellulose or something? The foam already has gelatin in it. Three of the four of us drank it too quickly to be an issue, but I thought there might be nice to slow down the melting a little if it were possible. So three of the four of you were reasonable. You just drank that sucker, right? I'm going to go back to what I said before. You're going to want to use some form of a fluid gel. So reinforced creams – so forget the gelatin. Throw the gel. Bah, gone, right? Get rid of it. You're also about to go vegetarian. Well, yes, but not vegan because you have egg yolks in it if you want. Whatever you want. What you're going to do is you're going to take the water and the milk, and that might be enough actually. Now, you might need to take a portion of the cream as well, and you're going to set it in a 1% as a 1% agar gel. You're then going to blend that gel. Now, you have to have enough of it. You have to make like 300 grams or more of this agar gel. And then you could do 1% is kind of high. You could do 1% and then just add enough cream back to it to get the texture way you want. So you're going to make an agar gel with this stuff, then blend the hell out of it. Then you're going to mix it with the cream and the egg yolks. You're going to shake it, right? And then remember, this is a fluid gel, okay? So you're going to need – and by the way, when you blend it, if it looks like little shards, then it's not blended enough. It has to look creamy. So then you put it in the whipped cream container. You flick the whipped cream – put your finger over the tip. First time doesn't matter. Second, third time it does. Flick down, right, to make sure that all the product is slammed against the head of it, then dispense. And the agar fluid gel will prevent meltout. I do this all the time.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, but I'm not done with all the ketchup questions.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of questions this week. So you can still...
All right, Mildred writes in on ISI and SodaStream. Hello, everyone at Cooking Issues. This is Mildred from Albany, New York, with a completely different question that I'm going to try the first batch of mushroom ketchup that we talked about before this weekend. I want to pick up an EC Whipper so I can try rapid infusions, but my housemates are more interested in picking up a SodaStream, who just posted a big loss. Their stock went way through the floor. Hopefully they can pick themselves back up. As a trial, I know that CO2 isn't strong enough to do decent infusions, but are we doomed to multiple devices? Can one use a CO2 cartridge as one of the types of EC Whippers for soda, and then an N2O cartridge for infusion or foam? If so, are there any specific accessories I can get to make it work, and what additional care and maintenance steps do I take to make sure I don't mess up with the Whipper? Thanks in advance, and keep it tasty, Mildred. Unfortunately, you will need multiple things. It's completely you will spend more... if you make any reasonable amount of seltzer, you will spend more trying to do seltzer in the Whipper than you will just doing it in the SodaStream. The SodaStream is much more convenient for making things like seltzer, and then keep the Whipper for whipped cream and infusions and stuff like that. You won't regret having them. They're different, but you can't really get one to do the thing for the other. I thought you said I had 2 more minutes. We're done.
Yeah.
Oh man,
you can do more ketchup on Tuesday's show though.
All right, listen, I have to talk about – I did all this research on Christoph and cooking bass.
It's still in your head.
And I did all – you know, talk about liquid smoke. What else am I going to talk about? We're going to talk about the way we cook brats with the food truck. We're finally going to get to the autolyse step with Calvel and bread, custards. Oh, my God. Fennel. Oh, my God. All this stuff. All right, so we'll get to it. Next week, the Almost Ketchup Show, Cooking Issues.
Thanks for
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.